This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. The Department of Safety is holding community discussions across the state on combating hate crimes. Christopher Cartwright attended the first meeting in Keene. He's the criminal justice reporter at the Keene Sentinel, and he joins us now over Zoom. Good morning, Christopher.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for the time. What did state officials say is their goal for these community discussions?
Yeah, so there were kind of a few goals. One was to share like legal resources for when someone is a victim or witnesses a potential hate crime, and also discuss ways communities can respond to these incidents, but also just to begin conversations in the county among residents and connect various disparate groups with each other. So the community can kind of begin to build a network of resources.
So at this meeting yesterday, who was there? What do they have to say?
There were around 50 attendees or so, and a wide variety of groups. There was the New Hampshire Attorney General was there, representatives from the U.S. Department of Justice, Keene Mayor Jay Kahn, also representatives from the Keene New Hampshire Human Rights Committee and Keene State College and the Keene High School principal. So a large selection of people. But the discussion kind of was into two parts. The first section, people discussed the legal resources. So the New Hampshire Attorney General, for example, he talked about the creation of the department's Civil Rights Unit in 2017 and the recent expansion. They added three new employees to that unit. But a large discussion was sparked from a question from a Keene resident about, you know, what should they do if they witness a hate crime or a hateful act towards someone. And there were various opinions given. It sparked some debate. Some people said that, especially on the legal side, observing what's happening and noting characteristics of the aggressor for a law enforcement response would be useful, and providing support to the victim while not interfering and necessarily escalating the altercation was also important.
Yeah, and Christopher, what solutions are they looking at for people specifically in Cheshire County? Are there outreach? Are they talking about other meetings? What are they looking at as far as solutions and reaching out to people?
Yeah. So the second half of the meeting, people separated into four different groups where they could, talk about these questions and share ideas. And then everyone reconvened for a panel. And the general overview of what everyone talked about was kind of the difference between a law enforcement response versus a community response to hate crimes, and some people who were attending suggested kind of building a network of leaders who can be trained on knowing what to do if a hate act or hate incident occurs, and can provide support at following that. And then also the importance of bringing these issues to light, even if it doesn't warrant a legal action. And finally, just kind of holding vigils and rallies, like Sean Locke, who heads the New Hampshire Attorney General's office, the civil rights unit there, he even suggested that that's one of the most powerful responses to a hate act, is showing that the community stands with the group affected.
Right. Yeah. And does the state plan to hold more of these conversations?
Yeah, definitely. So they don't have a specific schedule yet, but Eddie Edwards, the assistant commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Safety, he told me the tentative plan is to hold another discussion in the Seacoast region, followed by one up north in the state, and then finally ending with a statewide event.
Christopher, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Christopher Cartwright is a reporter for the Keene Sentinel. You can find more of his reporting at sentinelsource.com. I want to bring in NHPR reporter Todd Bookman now to the conversation. Todd, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Todd, you've been following the state's attempt to address this rising extremism and acts of bias here in New Hampshire. Can you tell us more about the kinds of incidents that have been taking place across the state, across the region in general?
Yeah, there's no real pattern to these. We've seen acts of anti-Semitism in Portsmouth now on a few separate occasions. That has included vandalism, spray-painted swastikas. Earlier this month, someone took a hammer to the lights outside of Temple Israel. There was also some anti-Semitic vandalism in Hopkinton last year. There have also been some civil rights cases brought recently, and one of those involved a man who left a threatening note on a car in a Walmart parking lot that had a Mexican flag displayed in the window. So again, no real pattern, but the data shows there's, you know, more of these seemingly one-off events happening, and that's the concern.
Yeah. What else has the Attorney General's office been doing outside of these community conversations that Christopher was talking about?
Yeah, well, they've been staffing up. So the Attorney General's office has brought on additional attorneys and investigators to the Civil Rights Unit. The unit previously really just had one attorney trying to manage these cases, but I think there were more than 400 complaints received last year alone. And so the office has recognized, that it needs to add additional resources. Christopher noted that the U.S. Attorney's Office took part in the event yesterday. The U.S. Attorney's Office, which we should, that's the federal government, they're also beefing up their enforcement division for civil rights crimes. So we have sort of these two things happening simultaneously. We have stepped up enforcement, but these community events, which really are an effort to, spread awareness and encourage people who are targeted to come forward.
Right. Todd, let's turn to another story from you this week. The state Senate recently approved a bill that would require abortion providers to share data on procedures they perform with the state public health official, with state public health officials. Why do lawmakers think that this data is so important for state officials to have?
Yeah, it's not just lawmakers who want good data on abortions. Abortion providers, by and large, also support the publication of good data. The issue here is sort of what specifically is going to be collected. How's it going to be aggregated and made public? What will it be used for? It's really sort of a fight over the details. And the dispute in New Hampshire right now is that Democrats, abortion providers in this state, they didn't get a chance to weigh in and help craft this GOP amendment because it was sort of tacked on late in the legislative process. So there was no public hearing. The amendment itself doesn't have a lot of detail about how specifically providers will collect this data and report it. And so there's kind of skepticism that this is a well-intentioned piece of legislation. Republicans, for their part, they argue that the data they're asking for is pretty common across other states and that it will be used to answer very basic questions that often come up when people debate abortion policy. How many are actually taking place? What is the sort of range of gestational age of the fetus, the residence of the pregnant patient? So that's sort of where things stand right now with this bill, with this amendment.
How common is it for states to track this data?
Oh, it's very common. 46 other states in the District of Columbia, they already collect and publish this data. And so you have some states, that have very strong abortion rights laws on the books doing this. And then you've got states that have essentially a banned abortion in the wake of the Dobbs decision, who are also collecting this data. So these numbers are out there. And I'll note that New Hampshire abortion providers, they actually voluntarily already share aggregated abortion numbers with a nonprofit research institute. It's called the Guttmacher Institute. This is a sort of a nationwide institute that's widely respected amongst sort of abortion providers. And the providers told me, they share data with Guttmacher because they trust Guttmacher to produce good data. The issue right now is sort of whether or not there's trust in the state and those pushing for this.
Right. Okay. So generally, providers want this data to be made available, but Senate Democrats mostly opposed to this bill here in New Hampshire. What have they been saying to you specifically?
Well, there are concerns about privacy, that the law or the amendment as written isn't clear enough that certain data won't be shared with providers. From providers to the State Department of Public Health. Republicans reject that. And then the other issue that has flared up is about gestational age, like, what systems can be used to determine the age of the fetus? Will it require an ultrasound? Could the pregnant person just sort of relaying the date of their last menstrual cycle? Could that be enough? And that's been going back and forth. Senate Republicans clarified again this week that there is no mandatory ultrasound as they see it under this bill. Mm-hmm. But that's very much been, the focus of the debate here.
Just in a few seconds, what's next for the bill, Todd?
So it has cleared the Senate on a party line vote. It will now head to the House, where it will have a full public hearing that was supposed to be scheduled for next week, but it's been canceled for unclear reasons. But at some point in the future, we'll get a public hearing, and then the full House will vote.
And HPR's Todd Bookman. Todd, thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Let's turn to some other news this week. It is prom season, but not everybody gets the prom night they may have wanted. A group of students are giving their peers a do-over. Olivia Richardson recently attended a prom for LGBTQ plus students, and she's here to tell us about it. Hey, Olivia.
Hey, Rick.
Welcome to the recap. So, Olivia, tell us more about the students who put this prom together. What was their motivation?
Yeah, it was about a group of students from around the state and also around New England came together, and they were looking to put on a prom for students who missed out during COVID, or also maybe they weren't out at the time that they were attending their prom. And so it's really an intercollegiate event. It was not just Dartmouth students that were there. There were people from MIT, Colby Sawyer College, UNH attended. And it was started just with the mission of taking this idea of a queer prom and idea to making it happen.
So tell us about the party. What was it like?
Well, it was held at a Dartmouth Student Center. Immediately when you walked in, there are streamers, you hear the music, and you come into this giant open hall, and there's like this disco ball, and it's reflecting all these lights. And behind the DJ booth, there was the rainbow pride colors. And it was just a really nice event where they had tacos. And instead of doing like a prom king and queen, they did the prom monarch and majesty, which is a little bit more gender neutral. They also had a category of most fierce, best dressed for the night as well. So a lot of people just brought themselves and had a lot of fun.
So what were the students saying about the experience?
A lot of students were experiencing their first prom. Some students come from countries where they might not have a prom altogether, or maybe their country might not be as open to different queer LGBTQ experiences. And then other students, you know, they had prom, but again, it wasn't, they weren't out. So they were just having fun and enjoying themselves. And actually, one of the Pride organizers, Felipe Mendoza from Dartmouth, also had a lovely night, and you can hear him here.
So everyone dressed so amazingly, and then we're having the monarch and majesty of the whole prom. It all feels so magical, and it feels like that it belongs to the community and is like for the community.
Yeah, and then also Abigail Farley, she's a student at Franklin Pierce University. She was really excited to attend. It was like her first prom or first queer prom ever. She didn't realize she was trans when she was in high school. And so this was like an event for her that was just, she was nervous about it. She was happy to just jump into different activities. And then she actually ended up winning prom monarch for the night. So she was really excited.
Olivia, I'm so glad you could bring us that story. Thank you.
Thank you.
And HPR's Olivia Richardson. You can find more of her work and the stories that you heard, by the way, this morning on NHPR.org. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR.